welcome back. For as long as there have been people on the planet, at least for the last 3,000 years, of course we know it goes back much further than that, the fascination with the monuments at Giza, some much older than 3,000 years, of course, has never diminished, and in fact today probably is more, well, keyed up than ever before. There are treasures at Giza, which of course have been kept secret from all of us by the Egyptian antiquities folks who don't think we're fit to know what's really going on there. But thanks to imaging, X-ray, radar, and satellite technology, we do know that there are tunnels and all over the Giza Plateau. It's an extraordinary place which has yet to be fully disclosed to the public and probably never will, quite frankly. Now, a gentleman who has been involved in researching the magical mysteries, the timeless mysteries, maybe the ultimate answers to questions, kinds of mysteries, the most, and has worked the hardest on the Internet to bring this information together from all sorts of wonderful scholars, is Dr. John DeSalvo, a great friend of this program for many, many years. John is a Ph.D. and the director of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association and vice president of a team of scientists studying the Shroud of Turin, on which he has lectured widely. John makes frequent radio appearances, like tonight, to discuss the latest developments in pyramid research and is responsible for disseminating the Russian and Ukrainian pyramid research to the rest of the world, which we have done on this program first with John in years gone by. And that's extraordinary. Now, to have a vision, a dream for a book about the status of what we know about the pyramids at Giza is something that many people hold. Few, if any, there are a few, actually live to see their dreams manifested in a glorious book like John DeSalvo has. This book is brand new. It is called Decoding the Pyramids, Exploring the World's Most Enigmatic Structures. They are far more than enigmatic, of course, but that's certainly a good front cover tease. Dr. John DeSalvo has been working on this book for a long time. We'll get the story. We're going to find out what's in it and talk to him about many other things as well. Decoding the Pyramids, again, is the name of the book, and it brings together the very latest theories about the Great Pyramid of Giza and recent breakthroughs in pyramid research all around the world. This is an amazing book, and I truly mean when I say this is a glorious production of a book. I don't know how they could have really put together such a magnificent book with so much information, with so many pictures. You know, when you have pictures, you often lose the text, but it's the perfect marriage of it. When you pick this book up and start thumbing through it, you'll want to sit down with it for a long time, or at least have it on your nightstand. This is amazing. So with all of that said, let's welcome back our good friend and colleague, Dr. John DeSalvo. Hello, J.D.
Hi, Jeff. Listen, it's a pleasure and honor to be back on the program with you, and thanks for all those wonderful comments about the book. As you know, I'm very excited over it. This really was a dream come true.
How many years, John?
About five, and I've tried so hard to get it published, as you know, throughout the years,
and to have
Barnes & Noble publish it, my favorite bookseller of all times, was just such an honor, and again, a fulfillment of 5 years. And as you know, I got to certain points, I was just ready to give up, and I spent all this time and dedication.
I remember all those phone calls late at night when you were crying and just ready for suit. I had to say, don't, John, just hang in there.
Hey, you were cheaper than a psychiatrist, so what the heck, right?
That's right. It's truly a story, and so many people want to be published now, and you got your number one book publishers behind this. How did that happen? How did that come about?
Well, I tell you, it was a long journey, and I want to say it right up front. I want to thank you for the many, many years of support you've always given me, and they're true friends and few people like you in this world, and I really appreciate and cherish our friendship and want to thank you. But, you know, this was, again, when I started the association, oh, my God, was it about 8 or 9, almost 10 years ago?
Right.
It got to the point that I felt I was very objective. I didn't have any one theory of my own to put together all the known theories, mainly alternative viewpoints of the Great Pyramid. And so, you know, I did that, and I basically put a little book together, a 500-page book back in 2003, kind of self-published it, hoping that this would be a sample that a publisher would look at and maybe pick up on. And, sending it out to many publishers, I really got nowhere. And,
lots of postage, yes.
Uh-huh. I'm sure, a lot of your listeners who know what it's like. It's, it's not for the money or fame. It's a dedication. And I know people have spent years, and it's very discouraging getting back the letters or the, email saying, thank you, but no thanks. Well, I was really, again, fortunate. I really say that I'm very lucky to be hooked up with a literary agent, David Alexander, in the U.K. This man, by the way, is brilliant and put together incredible publications, bestsellers, one of the most creative people in the business. And he had it, as soon as he saw the book that I wanted to put together, he saw the vision for it, and he thought this book really had potential if done right. If you remember, the one I put together had a lot of black and white photos. There wasn't really a great artistic component with it, but he envisioned the text with this magnificent group. We have over 200, 250 color photos, diagrams, whatever. So he basically put the layouts, some sample layouts together and worked with other designers. And sold the idea to Barnes & Noble. And it was a lot of work. And it was the most rewarding and fulfilling thing I just about ever did. It's really funny. I think I've told you this privately. I was at the point where I was ready to give up and said, I never want to write again. I'm never going to send this book to anybody else. I don't want to say I wasted all this time. I mean, it was very enjoyable. But my suggestion to people out there is don't give up. Keep if you have a dream and you believe in it, keep plugging away, because there's someone out there that will have that same dream with you. And assuming, obviously, there's substance and you have a message that's important, I think the forces of nature, of God, or the spirits, or the angels, whatever you want to call or believe in it, will help manifest that dream. And so it was funny. It was, too, during that week was when David contacted me and said, we have a publisher and we're ready to go. But the thing I couldn't believe, Jeff, is what they were going to do to the book. I never would have believed the final outcome. And like you said, even the cover, I spoke to some of the people over there at Barnes & Noble, and they said basically it was really a beautiful cover. I've never seen anything like it. I guess the kind of hieroglyphics imprint over it is called Spot UV, which I never heard of before.
Who did the artwork, do we know?
Yes. I want to make sure I acknowledge these people, but there's quite a few people. Sarah Howard was the art director, and she's in the U.K., and Mary Todd was the senior project editor, who I worked out. Some days we had 14-hour days with, working on the layout. Carolyn Earle was an editorial director. Mm-hmm. They had several people researching the photographs, the design, and then the Barnes & Noble corporate New York. Peter Norton was the publisher and director of co-editions, and our senior editor, Cynthia Barrett, oversaw the operation. So, I mean, there's numerous people involved. My main contact was Mary Todd, who is just a wonderful editor to work with. Everyone was. See, that's the other thing, too. I made new friends with this project.
Uh-huh.
Everything was enjoyable. When I hear sometimes authors say, oh, it was terrible, the editors, took my book apart.
I'm sure maybe some of our listeners are anticipating this, but we all know what happened here. They were inspired by your work. They were inspired by the material they got to work with. That's the bottom line here. Had you not delivered, wouldn't have happened this way. But this is a reflection of your material, and they took it and they ran with it.
Well, I appreciate that. I guess it was a joint effort. It was something that everyone put a piece of creativity in, and again, seeing the birth of this baby was just amazing. And it's funny, Jeff, when I look at the book too, I don't even recognize it as my book is so amazing. But I don't want to go off too much, but I really have to acknowledge, I appreciate that. I really wanted to acknowledge the people that made it happen. And also, you know, the most important lesson, again, for people that have, whether it's your songwriter or writing a book or whatever, an artist, keep going. Don't give up on your dream.
Very good. All right. Makes sense to me. And this this book when is it in stores? Is it in stores now, John?
Right. It's in just about most all Barnes and Noble stores. It should be on the Father's Day table in all the stores.
Think.
So as soon as
perfect.
You go in the store, you can't have better placement than that, you know?
Yeah, no, it's perfect. It's called, again, Decoding the Pyramids, Dr. John DeSalvo, PhD, Exploring the World's Most Enigmatic Structures. This will educate everyone. I mean, even people in the field are going to benefit from this book. It's just packed full of extraordinary science, but the illustrations bring it all to an accessible, comfortable, and intriguing level. All right, back in just a couple minutes with John DeSalvo. Part one of Dr. John DeSalvo's magnificent new book called Decoding the Pyramids, and it truly would make a marvelous Father's Day gift that probably the whole family will pass around and read. I mean, this again is one of our greatest achievements on the planet. If we did it, and that question is not completely answered. We start out, of course, with part one, the Great Pyramid, which is the place to start. And again, the photographs are... they're just stunning. Let me ask you to talk about one thing that most people, and I don't know what the percentage might be, but if we were to ask 100 people, is this what the pyramid looked like in ancient times? They would say, yeah, pretty much. But the truth, of course, is no, didn't look like this at all, because it was covered with brilliantly polished white limestone, which is only remaining on a few places. This thing must have been so dazzling. Well, they say it could have been seen from the moon, right? Or orbit or something?
Star.
Yeah, yeah.
It would look like a shining star on Earth, exactly.
Yeah.
And that casing stone, as you mentioned, the polished limestone, can you imagine being in the desert and the sun
coming across
overhead?
That? With that coming? No, no. That it would have been just stunning. It would have been otherworldly. I mean, these were not funeral buildings for bodies. It's something else obviously going on here, nature.
And I always liked your idea. You always were a creative genius. Remember you said many years ago, if the Egyptian government was smart, they would kind of refurbish the casing stone on the Khafre's pyramid.
Yep.
And that would be an incredible tourist attraction.
They did one side, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I always loved that idea, you know. And restoring old monuments or whatever, historical places, means so much to the world. And today, you know, we're tearing down things for parking lots and just getting rid of our historic places. And here we have one of the greatest monuments, in my opinion, in the world, and restoration and bringing it back to at least parts of it to what it may have been originally like, it just would be a wonderful gift to the world. So I hope that happens someday.
Well, it would be a very wise investment for the Egyptian government to do. Orientation and dating. What is our best projection, John, as to the actual age of the Great Pyramid?
Well, you know, that's really a good question. And I think probably one of the most important questions, because once you can place it in some kind of time frame, you can, you know, like a detective, you know a little bit more about what, you know, maybe who built it and the reason.
Right.
I think, you know, again, you know, the traditional Egyptologists place it around, you know, 3600 BC, the reign of Khufu. But because of the erosion studies, you know, of John Anthony West and Robert Schock, that shows that it had to have been the erosion on the you know, on the Sphinx and the Sphinx wall would have had to have been produced by rainfall, which would not have occurred in recent times. It has to have been at least 10,000, you know, B.C. Or, or earlier. I mean, at the earliest. So I think the important thing is you really take it out of the time frame of the Egyptian culture, the dynastic period, the pre-dynasty times, and you're bringing it way, way back. And when I say 10,000 B.C., I mean, it could be 50,000 B.C. It could be 100,000 B.C. You know, we don't know. Once you get back that far, very few artifacts have survived, you know, longer than that. Than 10,000.
That is a literal possibility that the Great Pyramid could be 50,000 years old. It's a possibility.
And some have actually proposed it going back that far. And I think, you know, if the question's out there. Now, you know, you mentioned something really interesting at the beginning, you know who built it, who's responsible. And you know, we talk about in the book and I on your shows as many diverse possibilities as people from Atlantis or aliens or an advanced culture, all kinds of time travelers, interdimensional people. I mean, it sounds like science fiction, but you know, it's really scientific because when you start to rule out the traditional ideas of the Egyptian culture using wooden hammers and copper chisels, I mean, it's impossible that they would have built something like this. You have to look at every other possibility. Now, obviously, you want scientific facts to say which one is most likely, and unfortunately, we really don't know. But I like I said, I usually say I'm feeling 10,000 and beyond, and we have no idea how far beyond really is.
When you talked about chisels and people of the Egyptian dynastic periods, let's get that on the table right away. There is no way that the Egyptians built these pyramids in the time frame that common history tells us they did. Didn't happen. Didn't have the tools, didn't have the technology. I don't care how many slave laborers they had. Didn't happen. That's not a possibility.
I agree with you 100%. And, there were some calculations showing that even, you know, if they had a crew working for 20 years nonstop with no vacations, they'd have to lay a brick every, 2.5-ton brick every 90 seconds, or, you know, depending on the calculation, an impossible feat. The ramps to bring the bricks up would be much bigger than the pyramids. There's just no way. You know, even remember some of the specials on TV, they tried to build even small pyramids.
Right.
Even get really, you know, it was really a joke. And even with our modern equipment and cranes, you know. So I agree with you. And that's why I think that's what really got me interested in the pyramids. It's once you eliminate the traditional methods, and, you know, you start to say, what else is there? And it brings up ideas like levitation and all kinds of strange possibilities.
Right. Well said. Stand by. This book has everything, and because of the upcoming Indiana Jones movie, I should mention also the Crystal Skulls are included in this. Massive epic of reporting the mysteries of the pyramids. Decoding the Pyramids by Dr. John DeSalvo, Ph.D. Back in a minute. Okay, back with John DeSalvo, talking about his brand new book, Decoding the Pyramids. You'll see this in the store, folks. The cover is black with a magnificent twilight picture of the pyramids at Giza illuminated in the evening, and it's really something. The fourth, I guess it was the 14th century, 15th century, when they stripped off those polished white limestone casings. 1400, something like that. The Arabs used them to build a lot of mosques and yeah, other structures.
There was like an earthquake, you know, in that area, and so I guess there was some of the casing stones started to fall off and crumble, and they, I assume, looked at it as an opportunity to, you know, to take them and use them to build mosques and whatever, which is really a shame because you can imagine.
I'm stunned when I see it. I have seen not the best, but some fairly good efforts to give us a visual idea of what they must have looked like, and it's overwhelming. I mean, to come across something like that, all beautiful white polish. Wow. Now, that's not to say that the later dynastic Egyptians didn't use them for funerary and burial attempts and all of that, but that's not the story, folks. It's just not. It's not. And we get into the science of what pyramids do in the book as well. We've talked about that in the past, and it goes on and on and on. How many relics? And I mentioned early in the program about the issue of thermal imaging tomography, being able to tell us what's under the ground, under the sand. Have you spent much time, or do you have any good sources about that, John? We do know that there are tunnels, apparently hundreds of miles of tunnels under the Giza Plateau. What else is under there?
Actually, you know, one of our research directors, Dr. J.J. Hertek, is a remote sensing expert and has done a lot of those studies with other research teams, and he basically has told me privately and that there is an immense network of tunnels beneath the Giza complex, linking everything. A lot of it hasn't been released yet, but it's supposedly mind-boggling. And a lot of people in the past have suspected it, and there's been studies that have tended to imply that. But it seems like, you know, different groups are collaborating that with other groups. So. And some of those, you know, underground complexes have been released. We've seen some of those explorations.
But and they're not just water tunnels, folks. There's something else very major that these tunnel systems were used for.
Yeah, I think you hit on it. I think we're talking about there's something significant down there. There's something significant involved with these tunnels, all related to the function and structure of these pyramids, the Sphinx, and what it may put it all together. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, it'd be pure speculation on my part. Mm-hmm. But you see, that's why when we start to talk about this, and then we look at a structure underneath that's maybe even more elaborate than what we see above.
Right.
It starts to put this thing way back in time, and again makes the question come up: like, who are the builders? Who are the designers? Who could have constructed a project like this? So it does, you can understand why if I was an average scientist and you see something like this, you read about this, you see this data that's inconsistent with the traditional hypotheses of what the pyramid is, it's going to hook you. It's going to say, there's something here. This is exciting. And you know me, I always get hooked on something that's a mystery, especially if there's some kind of I was going to say spiritual significance. I think, too, the pyramids, and I talk a little bit about this, there's a spiritual component. People are drawn to the pyramid because it's awakening something inside them about who they are, where they're going, what their purpose is.
Or what they've experienced long ago in the collective unconscious. Who knows?
Exactly. What I find very interesting, and you may find it strange because, I'm a trained scientist, is the paranormal aspects of the pyramid because they're validated by many other people. It appears that there are a lot of reports of, paranormal experiences in the King's Chamber, especially people that lay in the coffer, you know, the granite box that nothing was ever found in it, no mummy or whatever. I know personally scientists who have had out-of-the-body and strange experiences in there, and they find it strange because it's not their nature. You know, they're not people that experiment with, you know, new age and metaphysical concepts.
Right. But, well, you know people who have spent time in that box up there, in that room. There are people who have actually slept overnight in there.
Right. Oh, Pat Flanagan, Dr. Flanagan, who wrote the introduction for the book.
And have Pat on the program pretty soon again, yeah.
Right, or the forward, I should say. He also, you ask him about that because he has told me some incredible stories. But I wanted to point out, too, in the appendix, Dr. Flanagan, who's been a very good friend of mine over the years, a great inspiration, allowed me to reprint his entire chapter. We modified it from his original book on pyramid power, the bestseller back in the 70s, on how to build model pyramids, because a lot of students always ask me how, you know, for science projects. So there's a section in there also. But getting back to the paranormal aspects, it appears that there's a higher level of radioactivity in the King's Chamber, and certain monolithic structures and ancient monuments have high levels of radioactivity. So there could be some kind of scientific component that's involved in all this. And I always believed this, that the paranormal and the metaphysics is not something unusual or a freak of nature. It's just a law of nature which we haven't discovered. Just like, lightning and electricity looked as something, you know, paranormal before we understood what it was. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's unusual to think about like this. There's certain laws of nature that we haven't discovered that are higher and higher. Gravitation, Newtonian physics was replaced by Einstein. Now, string theory may replace that. So, and that's why I hope people, think about these things, that looking into these new ideas, what we consider paranormal, is not going into strange territories. It's just saying, hey, modern science can't explain this with the laws and theories we have. There's got to be something above that. And so if we look at these, it may give us insight. And that's the problem I see with modern academia, is they're afraid to explore in these realms. They don't feel they're scientific. And I think that's wrong. And if you look back, all scientific discoveries were made by exploring into unknown areas.
I think you put your finger on it right there. They're afraid. They don't want to rock the boat. There have been a lot of careers that have been dashed by people who have gone off into very creative and constructive areas and have come back and tried to publish. Doesn't work. There's a lot of entrenched resistance to discovery and advancement in our understanding of our birthright, and that is to know what's going on in the past on this planet. Okay, right back in just a couple with John DeSalvo. Hard to think of the pyramids and ancient Egypt without thinking of Boris Karloff's amazing immortal movie, The Mummy, which I think captured in a way, John, the flavor of that period better than any later Hollywood epic. It was just eerie, the black and white and the flashbacks and wild stuff.
Yeah, I miss those classic movies. They really had a class and creativity, They used. We don't see a lot of that, unfortunately, I feel, in some of the modern stuff.
No, we just see product. All product.
Yeah, that's true.
It's all formula stuff. The Sphinx, for our listeners who are Edgar Casey aficionados, anything about under the paw of the Sphinx, down a chamber down below that is known? We've heard about it for a long time. What do we know about that? Anything?
Nothing new except, some remote sensing shows there, under the paw of the Sphinx. There could be, a chamber or a cavity. Again, the traditional Egyptologist.
Excuse me, John, these issues could be resolved easily if the Egyptian government wanted to do it. It's a political mess from A to Z.
Yeah, I really don't understand it. I mean, what do they have to lose? The only thing is, and I know we've talked about this before, it's whether it's politics or pride or whatever, the Egyptians want to feel that the Egyptian culture built
created all these monuments, right?
Right, and the Sphinx. So maybe they feel if it was a previous culture that occupied the land, or it was some other group of people.
It would
people.
Detract from their national heritage.
Yeah, and to me, I don't know why they feel that way, but I guess I could understand that. I don't think it does. I think it just, I think that's probably the reason. And maybe, too, there's politics and who's going to do the studies. You know, they want maybe their people to do it, but there's more technological advances by other universities and people. I don't know if that's a factor, because they've had other scientists and groups from other universities come in. So I just don't know. I think maybe the fear of finding something that would prove that the ancient Egyptians didn't build the pyramid. That's all I can think, unless there's some hidden motivation.
I think there's more to it. I think there's more to it. But
you know, it could be. I hate to say this, but you know, when we talk about certain cover-ups, whether it's UFOs or whatever, could there be something very, very significant that people are aware of over there in the Egyptian Giza place that far surpasses this whole problem of whether the Egyptians built it or not? That's an interesting thing to ponder, you know.
Right. Sure.
And if it is, you know, what that would be. I also believe that studying the Great Pyramid of Giza, the Sphinx, and the Egyptian monuments is one of the greatest motivations to getting young people, students, interested in these type of studies and interdisciplinary studies, and motivating people to think. And when you have the politics like the stifling research that could be done, and like you said, the answer to the questions, what's underneath, are there secret chambers, it's very frustrating. And unfortunately, we have to deal with it, I guess, and just be patient. And hopefully maybe somebody will come in power there that will allow these studies and encourage them.
The first person to write about the pyramids was the Greek historian Herodotus, who visited in the 4th century B.C., 440.
Right.
The capstones were all in place. These polished limestone casing stones are still to be seen in places at the base of one of the pyramids, I know. And he said that they were so polished and so perfectly laid over the big blocks that everyone sees now that the joints were so fine they could hardly be seen. And we're supposed to believe that men with Bronze Age chisels did this, or practically
laser thin. And in fact, if you tried to break the blocks apart, before the joint would break, the blocks would break. The cement is so fine. Supposedly, it's really an unknown mixture. Some companies in the past have said they
poured it.
That was interesting what you mentioned too. And Herodotus mentions that he said the casing stone was intact, but there was no capstone on the pyramid that he could remember as far back as time before Christ. So one of the big mysteries was there a capstone that was removed, destroyed, pilfered? Was it never put on because they didn't finish the pyramid? Was it not put on because there was a reason, a structural, a functional reason for it not to be there? Real mysteries, very interesting, very intriguing. I have an interesting theory. Is the capstone the powerhouse? Was that something that would activate the pyramid to whatever its purpose was? They didn't want to leave it up there because it would have been too powerful or too dangerous. You know, again, speculations, and I don't like to favor any one theory, but these are all interesting things to talk about.
Oh, yeah, you bet. The idea that these are machines of some kind, of course, has been written about brilliantly by Christopher Dunn in his book, The Giza Power Plant. And that is another one that would be a perfect companion to John's book to understand.
I've always enjoyed Chris's work and many other theories too, all different kinds of possibilities in terms of the engineering aspect or things the Russians came up with, and Joe Parr, his brilliant work.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that next.
Yeah, and other great researchers. And I think Stephen Mailer and his work with in indigenous culture and Hakim. Mm-hmm. It's just, I feel really fortunate to have been working with people like Chris Dunn and Stephen Mailer and J.J. Hertek and Pat Flanagan, and go on and on. Just brilliant researchers, all have, you know, I think Stephen said this many years ago. It's like everyone seems to have a little piece of the puzzle, and I think that's the case. No one has the answer. I don't believe any one theory is better than any others at this point, because it really doesn't, it answers part of it. But the whole point of the association that I started 10 years ago was, if we put enough of these people together, these brilliant researchers, with all a piece of the puzzle, maybe we can come up with the answer. And so that's what I think is very important, is for all the researchers and people to keep an open mind and don't get locked into one theory or one idea, and just look at it all together, put it in a mix, and maybe the answer will come out. So, again, and like I said, we have over 30 board members and all, I feel, top researchers, and you know, I'm honored to work with these people, and I respect all their theories. And it's just exciting. And I think, too, we're very scientific, as you know, Jeff, and the way we approach this. We don't just jump at one thing or another. We want some facts and evidence to support it. And even though we encourage speculation. So, yeah, there's so many really other good books out there also. I have, by the way, in the back of this book, I think it's one of the longest bibliographies ever printed on on the Great Pyramid. What I did is try to incorporate every book from the 17th century to the present that I'm aware of on the Great Pyramid, and I even used books from the 1800s with their bibliography. So, of course, it's not complete, and some of the more recent ones aren't in there, but it's a good starting point for scholars and students if they really wanted to have an exhaustive study.
Right.
I was going to say, to libraries. If I want to make a pitch out there, if you buy my book, buy two copies and donate one to your local library or university library.
That's a wonderful idea.
My dream is to get this book. The book's only $12.98. I can't believe how they can put a 192 hardcover book together with over 200 photos for that price.
Now, how? And these are color, too, most all of them.
Yeah,
how do they do it?
I can't believe it. So, you know, buy two copies, and my next dream would be to have this book in every library in the country and have students have access to it. So,
I would have figured it was double that if, you know, I didn't know. I figured it's $25
a book. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to last long because, like I said, when I run into people on the street, the thing they always talk about is they like the History Channel, and they like all the documentaries, and I mentioned I'm involved with pyramid research. So they want to talk to me, and I think when people walk in looking for a Father's Day gift and see a book like this for that price, and knowing their father, say, watches the History Channel. I've been in Barnes and Noble stores where the people pick it up and say, hey, I'm going to buy this for my son or daughter who's a student, you know. So that's really, you know, I've been an educator all my life. I've never done anything for money, and I've always done things for dedication. And to me, if this would make a real big impact on students and, you know, is the most rewarding thing that could happen. So that's why, yeah, I encourage you, get it into the libraries, and if you have a student in high school or college, get a copy to them. I'm sure they'll enjoy it, you know.
They'll more than enjoy it. Every page is wonderful, and I particularly like this painting of Napoleon's battle, the so-called Battle of the Pyramids. It's a representation, but it's quite a good painting. And what a panorama that is.
You know, I got to give credit to these diners because I can't put a percentage on it, but I'd say more than 50%, maybe even close to 70%. They did the picture research. They got the pictures, the permissions, and picked the best ones out. You know, maybe 20 or 30% were from my previous book or whatever. So I got to give the credit to the creators of this book and the editors and art directors because man, I just when I started seeing the layouts, I thought, where are you coming up with these pictures? we have this several chapters on the Russian research, which I've done many shows on, you know, with you on the Russian research, and they're coming up with pictures that I never even got from the Russians. I don't know where they got those from. So I mean, never worked with a group of people like this before in my life. Just talented, resourceful, and ingenious. I'm really humbled, to be honest with you, to work with talent like this. I don't have that kind of talent.
Well, this is a book that'll be around, you know, forever. It's not one of those flash in the pans. You've got it all covered here, and it is covered succinctly, and it is covered clearly. And speaking of Napoleon, when he visited the Great Pyramid and asked to be left alone in that box, I guess, in the king's chamber, he was. And when he came out, it was reported that he looked visibly shaken up. When an aide asked him whether he had witnessed anything mysterious, he replied that he had no comment to make and that he never wanted the incident mentioned again. In 1821, when he was on his deathbed, a close friend asked him what really happened in the king's chamber. He was about to tell him, but stopped, shook his head, and said, "No, what's the use? You'd never believe me." Now that is an amazing story.
It really
okay,
is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fascinating. We'll be right back with John after the top of the hour.